Good evening. I'm Tony Heilman, the senior leader of the New York Society of Ethical Culture, and I want to welcome you to our home and to what promises to be a fascinating conversation this evening. I also want to welcome our distinguished guest, who you will meet shortly, and I want to thank our co-sponsors and friend, the Nation Institute, for joining us in making tonight possible. You of course know them, and you know the New York Society for Ethical Culture and our school and this magnificent landmark building that's been a part of the New York City landscape since 1910. But I suspect some of you may not be quite as well acquainted with ethical culture itself. This is the founding society of a movement that has been proudly progressive for 130 years. We are humanists, and as such, we place our faith in the demonstrated capacity of people to do wonderful things. Like Izzy Stone, whose life was an accomplishment, was celebrated in this very hall in 1989, we believe in and work to support individual freedoms in an open society. Our members have a long and storied tradition of activism and advocacy on civil liberties and human rights issues. And like many of you, we work to secure equal justice and opportunity for all in a caring, compassionate world. One of the commitments we ethical culturists make to each other and to the world in which we live is the commitment to continuously educate ourselves and others in ways that enable us all to act more ethically and effectively. And this evening's program is a continuation of that effort, as few endeavors ensure a transparent government like that of an attentive, perhaps aggressive, independent press. And reading and hearing about one who dedicated his life and talents to just such an effort is a rewarding and encouraging experience. So I invite you to get to know us better by checking us out on the web at NYSEC, that's NYSEC.org, NYSEC.org. Or you can stop by our table in the lobby where you can pick up literature and sign up to receive notices of future events like this one. And where? At that table, if you haven't already, you can make a small or large contribution to the society. This is a grand building that houses many, many events like this, and it's also a big and expensive place to keep available. So it's only through your generosity that we're able to continue to present experiences like this. So please help us continue serving New York and the world. And now I want to turn the program over to one who attended the Ethical Culture School. Joe Connison is an author, columnist for the New York Observer and Salon.com. He's the editor at the American Prospect and has a new book coming out in February entitled It Can Happen Here. And he will be introducing you to tonight's guest of honor, who will be signing her book, All Governments Lie, after the program this evening. Please stay around for that. Thank you all for being here, and enjoy the evening's program. Joe?
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the Ethical Culture Society and my friends at the Nation Institute for sponsoring this event. Izzy was a lifelong Nation guy. He was submitting articles to the Nation from a very young age and was a good friend of the Nation magazine, and I think the magazine was a good friend to him. And it's true that he was memorialized in this place when he died in 1989. So this is a very fitting place to have this celebration of Myra's wonderful book. I also want to say it's a great honor for me to be here, to have been asked to do this as somebody who is distantly related to Izzy, actually, by marriage. But before I knew that, I idolized him as a kid who wanted to be a journalist and read the weekly, which my parents faithfully subscribed to, in spite of some disagreements with him about some things, which maybe we'll get into later. Myra deserves her own introduction, which is that she's a lifelong journalist who started out at the Detroit Free Press as a young woman, breaking into a man's, what was then seen as a man's profession in the 50s. Later moved to Washington and worked on the Washington Star, and then for 3 decades on the Washington Post. She was a neighbor of Izzy and Esther Stone and knew them very well, and I would say that she has proved, with the publication of this really timely, important book, that she was the right person to write it. And you'll see that when you read it, and I think tonight you'll discover that as well. She has dedicated an extraordinary part of her life to compiling this story. It's not a small book. I mean, Izzy's life is put into the context of his times, as the title says, and I think anybody who reads this will understand why Myra thought this was not only an important piece of history, but a really urgent story to tell as well. And we're going to get into that this evening. So thank you for coming. And Myra, I want to ask you why you persevered at this very difficult task, because as it turns out, Izzy didn't leave much in the way of papers or documents himself. When at a certain point he was trying to convince me to come to Washington to work, and in his kind of expansive way said, you know, all this could be yours, young man. He was in his house and sort of pointed to some piles of papers and books stacked on the floor. And but it turns out there really wasn't anything there except perhaps his library. So how did you do this, and why did you want to do it?
Well, all of this may be yours someday. My son was one of Izzy's little quirks. He did this with everybody he knew.
Oh, and I didn't feel that special. I kind of knew that.
But I mean, Nick von Hoffman, they all said, you know, do I really want to take this over? And they saw what he had done. I had a lot of reasons to do Izzy, and one of the initial ones was my husband, who was to politics what Izzy was to journalism. He was a great civil rights activist and anti-Vietnam War activist, and had been a state senator in Florida. So he said, I think you ought to do this book. And I started, it was a labor of love very early on. And Judy Stone, who is Izzy's sister, I wanted to say hello to, because Judy was the first entree to the family who really would talk to me and help me out, and she has a perfectly marvelous book out, and she's speaking tomorrow night. This is an All in the Family gig right here. But anyway, it's called Not Quite a Memoir, and it is going to be at Drama Books, 250 West 40th Street, and she details much of her own experiences as a film writer and director. And also, I don't know if Peter Osnes is here. There you are, Peter. I'm plugging everybody's book. Peter's got a wonderful collection out of Izzy's columns. And the only thing that bothered me is that when I was working on this, I wanted to quote Izzy constantly. It was very hard to narrow him down. And the reason I felt so strongly about Izzy was that every time I turned around and started reading something, it was very applicable to what was happening today. Among the many things that I read was, but particularly that I got the last batch of FBI files in 2000, and there were about 5,000 pages. And this was the time of the beginning of Bush and the lies and the 5 years of enormous propaganda and the incredibly quiescent press and media who took everything as gospel. And I kept thinking, where is Izzy when we need him? And I thought the only way I could do that was to sort of present some of Izzy to you and what he probably would have been saying. One of the examples I love is he said, there was increased reliance at home and abroad on suppression by force and an increasingly arrogant determination to go it alone in the world. And I thought, that's George Bush. Well, of course, it was the Cold War policies. And then when the Weapons of Mass Destruction documents came out, and people didn't really examine, go into depth about any of the stories, I just knew that Izzy would have been saying, what is this really all about? As some of you may know, he was the absolute first person to get behind the lies of the Gulf of Tonkin excuse and fakery for going into Vietnam. And many people think it was later on, but he did it 2 weeks after LBJ said this, 1964. And in the 50s, he was warning about going into Indochina in a land war. And I always think if there had been other journalists who would have felt that way, everybody always talks about Cronkite, but Walter Cronkite did not even do anything demonstrative about this war being wrong until after Tet. And I just kept saying that Izzy was fantastic to me because he struggled against people who didn't want to listen to him a lot of times, and he was just constantly ebullient, constantly funny about it, kept saying, I have so much fun, I ought to be arrested. You know, he never really took it to heart like I think some others would. And the one line that I thought was very good, that when the Washington Post and the New York Times were very, very wrong on weapons of mass destruction, and they did what I call mini mea culpas, and the Washington Post story revealed that Walter Pincus, a very good editor and writer and who was a friend of Izzy's, had a story doubting the weapons of mass destruction before we went in the buildup of war, and the Post played it on page A17. And Izzy's great line always was, the Post was an exciting paper to read because you never knew on what page you'd find a page one story.
Well, they've apologized since then for burying Walter's stories, and now they're burying the stories that about doubts on Iran. So they sort of apologized and they're doing it over again. But
well, also the other one that the title of the book is based on is that one I heard President of ICE, Dick Cheney, saying that no matter what had happened, we would do it all over again exactly the very same way, and we have $300 billion spent. I don't know how many people killed. Osama bin Laden is still running around somewhere. The country over there is in chaos. And Izzy's line that I loved so much and why I used it for the title was, all governments lie, but disaster lies in wait for countries whose officials smoke the same hashish they give out. And I know he would have been saying they're smoking and inhaling if he was around right now. And of course, he had these one-liners that John Stewart would die for, I think. But that's just this tip of the iceberg. There was this enormous scholarship about him, an enormous sense of, let's get behind the facts. I'll maybe bore you with it, but I have some ideas that I'll tell you about later about why he should be remembered by journalists and what they could learn from him.
Well, at one point, I think you said that he was, in a sense, the first blogger. And that's kind
no,
of...
No, I never did that.
You
other
didn't
people,
say that?
Other people say I resent it, frankly.
Why do you resent it?
Well, Izzy actually resented it. That before he died, people were calling him the first laptop publisher. And he'd sit there and say...
First desktop publisher.
Desktop, right. Yeah. And he'd say, I have a printer. And he didn't mean something...
He did have a printer. Esther
right next
paper,
to you.
He
would drag you down to the place, and there it was, and he had the cold type, and he set everything in, and Peter was one of the assistants. Now he's this great publisher, but he was one of the ones that, he's wonderful in the book about how Izzy would summon him from the basement with a buzzer as an assistant and send him off to the State Department and all over the place. Izzy didn't just sit there in his bathrobe and write. I mean, he did an enormous lot of research. Now, I'm not saying that some blogs are very good, but my theory is about, as I said, that bad blogs don't die. They just fade away to the blogosphere, and they're there forever. The Ann Coulters of the world who have lied so consistently about Izzy.
Well,
you know,
I don't think
you
anybody
can find
would,
that everywhere
would
you look.
Compare him to Ann Coulter in any respect.
No, I'm not talking about him. I'm saying that every you can get Josh Marshall, and you can get all the, I mean, I love the fact that I can get on the internet and find your work or Molly Ivins or people that should be in the New York Times and Washington Post and aren't there anymore. I think that's great, but it's just that Izzy was more than most.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because I think Izzy, in fact, is known or remembered for his commentary. He was known for the opinions that he expressed on the issues of the day, such as civil rights, such as the Vietnam War, such as McCarthyism. I mean, and often very lonely positions that he took. But in fact, he was a great investigative journalist.
Absolutely.
I think he was equally interested in doing commentary and investigation. And that was a theme that went back to the beginning of his career, this kind of, he could hit from either side of the plate.
Yes, he was not, he really was a triple threat man. I mean, he went out and did straight reporting. He did columns. He was the youngest columnist in America, 23, 24 years old, warning about Hitler in 1933, and at a time when Walter Lippmann, who was the sage, was saying that Hitler was an okay guy and we shouldn't take him that seriously.
Well, we'll get to Walter Lippmann.
but Izzy did that, and he did have opinions, but by and large, he backed up his opinions with fact.
He had a long career as a straight reporter.
And he also broke, one of the things he used to say was, go into the bowels of government. Do not go at the top. Do not go to briefings because they're not that good. But he had nothing against having somebody go to an off-the-record briefing and then brief him so that he could use the material.
He was said to not. I mean, one of the things that's always been said about him was that he didn't go and spend a lot of time at press conferences and events like that, probably because he couldn't hear them.
Well, that
he was deaf.
Well, he turned that. He started to become deaf when he was 30, and he turned that into a real asset because he felt that he had to be able to know more and read. But before that, there's a friend of mine, Madeline Amgott, who was covering the State Department with Izzy. And when Cordell Hull was there, and there was a famous scene where Izzy asks the Secretary of State a question as I.F. Stone, which he had been for 7 years or more by then, and the Secretary of State stares at him and he says, you go by other names too, don't you? Which was a very anti-Semitic moment. And
because he was referring to his born name of Feinstein.
And that was picked up and used all over in the Congress. But John Kenneth Galbraith said, I think, the most important thing. He said Izzy was the most intractable of reporters, and he said even if he thought the way you might think on something, you couldn't get away with lying to him. He said as long as you knew that you weren't going to be lying, you were okay with him. But I wanted to tell you about at least two major, major scoops that he got simply by finding somebody in the government, and it wasn't from his mindset.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. How did he get his big stories, and what were the biggest stories?
Well, two of the big ones in the 40s is that he uncovered the fact that American cartels were still doing business with Nazi Germany and with Japan, and were dragging their feet.
Let's explain what that really. Let's give a little of the context that you give in the book.
Must
that.
I?
American cartels still doing business with Nazi Germany. Why was that? It was a crime, wasn't it?
Yes,
illegal.
It was a crime, and we were also at war with them.
Right.
I mean, a couple of little things like
and
that.
And yet, American oil companies and other major firms were.
Standard Oil was putting, was sending oil into Germany through Franco, Spain.
Right.
And Izzy broke that story, and it was. All over, and it forced all kinds of new regulations. And then he did another story, getting somebody inside the government who explained that he was, again, that they were ready to start doing business with IG Farben, who made the gas pellets
IG
for
Farben
the gas chambers.
The huge chemical cartel under the Nazi regime
and before. But this was in 1944 while the war was still ongoing, and he exposed that.
How did he get those stories?
Well, he got a whistleblower, and it's in the book.
I know it's in the book. I read it in the book. I'm asking questions that sound like dumb questions, but I know the answers to some of these questions.
Well, I said Izzy
had a
made-for-movie life, and so you have to go through all of
that. But that's a really great story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how he broke what was a huge story and in a way illustrates his maverick position against the conventional wisdom that persisted for a long time that we were on the wrong side in World War II, that in fact there had been no reason to oppose Hitler. He was alone in taking that position in the beginning. And
he didn't say that.
No, I'm not saying he said that.
He went against the conventional wisdom
yes. that said that.
Yes, well, that's very true. And all these people who always said that he was too close to Russia, Izzy in 1939 was furious about the pact that Stalin and Hitler made, which made that there would be a non-aggression pact. And then right after that, Hitler invaded Poland and the war began. Then there was this incredible switch in the United States where all of the American Communist Party said, well, we will not support this role. And then you had Lindbergh and all the others on the right wing who were saying, there's no reason to go into this war. And I read, and it amazed me because so many people think of this as the great generation of war, let's all go and be gung-ho about the war. But at one point, there were less than 12% of Americans who thought we should support Berlin, Great Britain, and the Lend-Lease. And all through that period, Izzy was pushing and pushing for it. And everything about him, he had this idealistic concept that fascism was the absolute worst thing that could happen, and there had to be a united front against it, and even going to war, although he was, I think, essentially a pacifist all his life. The first war that he really supported was the Spanish Civil War, because, again, he saw this as a theatrical setting for World War II. And so he had a vision that a lot of people could not see at the time.
So he flunked the physical.
Yeah, he did. Of course, he was. He couldn't see anything. He had these Coke bottle glasses, and it was.
So he never. He didn't.
And he
have
was
to,
deaf, and right, I think he had flat
go,
feet.
He didn't have to go abroad. So he spent the war at home doing investigative journalism, and he found a whistleblower who told him what American corporations were doing to support Hitler, even while we were at war. How did that happen? How did he find her?
Well, it was a woman who. As she told the story, she was a very young Antioch student, and she was working in the customs officials department. And
alien property.
Alien
custodian.
Property. Yeah, you're so much better at this than I am. Alien property. And she, a woman she was working for came up to her and said, I'm getting all of these documents over to Izzy Stone, and I can't do it tonight because I'm running off to see my husband who's leaving for the war. Would you please take them to Izzy? So she took them to Izzy, and Izzy, it was PM, and it was all over the top of the PM, which was this great New York newspaper that had no advertising. And she lost her job, and she lost everything.
Because it was discovered that she was leaking.
Well, no, they never really totally discovered it, but they called her in, and the FBI, I've got a thing here about the FBI I have to tell you, but they called her in, and she said she had nothing to do with it, but the suspicion was enough. That's the important point about the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover and everything. The suspicion was enough, and she was fired, and she thought that Antioch would support her, and they didn't, and she lost her chance at school.
College,
she
right.
left college. She became a good friend of Izzy's anyway. Izzy was furious and wanted to make a cause célèbre of it, but her family said, no, don't do it.
But he got a big story.
He got a huge story. But I think another one that people don't understand this sometimes, but J. Edgar Hoover was after people like Izzy Stone in the mid-30s. 1936 was when he began to pursue Izzy, because Izzy was very much anti
Well, there was an incident, Hoover. Wasn't there, that where Izzy sort of permanently provoked Hoover? Didn't he write something about Hoover or say something about Hoover that kind of caught Hoover's attention? And
it was just the typical, you know, Hoover was, he called him the sacred cow and the overblown Dick Tracy, and he was writing all of these stories. So Hoover scrawls on one of the memos I have, who is this guy and what do we have on him? And that was sort of the beginning of it all. And then in 1943, Izzy again got a scoop, and this was from an anonymous source. It was the forerunner of Felt with Deep Throat, because he worked at the FBI office, and Izzy wouldn't say even to his editor at The Nation who he was, and she didn't know who he was.
This was a story he published in The Nation.
Yeah, but no, it was before it was published. And so she came down and examined it and said, well, I think we can go with this. And
right.
So it was, the byline was Mr. XXX. And what he found were the kind of questions that they were asking of people who were trying to get into the government. And I thought I had it here. Maybe I don't. The questions were along the lines.
These were questions that they were asking of the friends of people who wanted to apply for a job
in
the government, right?
It's
phrased as like, is he too critical of Vichy France?
And it was worse than that. Is he friends
with a lot of Negroes?
Does he have any Jewish friends?
Does he have any Jewish
friends? Does he ever sing any subversive songs?
Right.
And on.
Because the FBI routinely interviews the friends of people who get jobs in the government. I mean, I've been interviewed about people who I knew who were getting jobs in the government, and was not asked any questions like that. But that was the typical questionnaire.
Here it was: does he mix with Negroes? Does he have too many Jewish friends? Do you think he is excessive in opposing fascism or Nazism? Did you ever hear him sing subversive songs? Does he read PM in The Nation? And I think one of the really fun scoops that Izzy got, and when David Brinkley told me this story, was that Izzy was so hard of hearing that he had these incredible antenna-like things that he was using at a time when people didn't have simple hearing aids. And there was a major story when they were working with the war production office, and Stone took his hearing aid off and pressed his hearing aid receiver against the conference room door, which the journalists were not allowed to go into, and they had been barred from, and he turned up the volume and heard everything and repeated it to everybody else. And I said, thus the world knew that automobile industry could no longer drag its feet on more manufacturing, because they sat there with the head of GM and said, no, Charlie, you cannot just build cars anymore. And Izzy got that one in a very different way than most people would.
So Hoover basically dogged Izzy's every step for about 30 years, correct?
Oh, more.
More.
Until Hoover finally, thank God, breathed his last breath. And I think he probably, of all the people that I've studied, is the most malevolent and vicious man, and really evil. And you know, people whose memories go back no further than his recent biographies, particularly as a cross-dressing homosexual.
In the article.
Who answered to the name of Mary on festive occasions.
How bad was Hoover? He was so bad that Christopher Hitchens thought he was a racist and a pervert. So you have to know he was really terrible.
Well, he was.
And what I have to say is a very good article by Christopher in the Vanity Fair about Myra's book this month. But
yeah, he actually liked it. But I'm serious. You know, he would answer to the name of Mary at various parties and stuff. And you think, here is this horrible man who was gathering such filth and
on so many people. Of course, now we would say nothing wrong with that, but
Well, not only if you're using it against other people. I'm only
which
talking.
Which simultaneously doing.
I'm
right?
only that talking about hypocrisy, Joe.
Correct. I understand that.
Anyway, but, I want to read just this quick one. This is the kind of clandestine and subversive things that they caught Izzy doing. September 27, 1951, agents 7 a.m., agents positioned in front of Stone's New York City apartment. 10:55 a.m., Stone came out and proceeded on foot east on 91st to Lexington Avenue. 2 minutes later, Stone entered Max Schwartz's cigar store. 1 minute later, Stone exited, no doubt in possession of at least one more cigar than when he went in. 3 minutes later, Stone entered a grocery store on the west side of Lexington Avenue between 89th and 90th. 6 minutes later, Stone came out of the grocery store with a bag of groceries, no slouch in the shopping department, and by 11:08, he was back home, and they stayed and watched for about 5 more hours before he came out, which time an agent could presumably yawn himself to death. And the reason I used a lot of this was because you can't imagine the amount of effort, the numbers of agents they used, and time and taxpayers' money on a man who, on pain of death, he could not have stopped writing and thinking what he felt. Well, and so we have a large, large legend of what they did to people, and Izzy was just one of them.
Well, but that brings us to another vexed subject, which is, was I.F. Stone a Stalinist? Was he a communist? Was he a fellow traveler? What? Because to this day, as you know very well, Izzy is accused by certain disreputable people on the right.
Very disreputable.
Of having been in the pay of the KGB. Which is based on something that a former KGB agent says and then denies that he said, that appears in a file that was uncovered some years back in the Kremlin. But Hoover, what struck me in the book was, having spent 30-plus years observing almost every move that Izzy made...
There was nothing.
There was nothing.
No, there was never anything about him.
And yet, he gave people reason to believe that he was too sympathetic to the Soviet
Well, I
Union.
Think that you have to go back into the period of time. First of all, he knew communists and had friends who were in the early 30s. He was a fellow traveler. He's never made any bones about that. You have to remember the time frame. That was when the Communist Party was, in many people's minds, doing good things for civil rights, workers, and was truly a bulwark against fascism. And what I think is amazing is the hypocrisy of life, because, and Izzy exposed this in his in the Weekly in the mid-50s, in the late 30s during the Popular Front, people like Thomas E. Dewey, who later became great red-baiting Republican presidential candidates, sat and posed with pictures with Earl Browder, who was the head of the Communist Party, because everybody was trying to get their assistance in labor work and,
right.
and running for office. And
being a communist wasn't so bad.
It was not. Of course it wasn't. And Ronald Reagan could thank his lucky presidential stars that the Communist Party didn't want him. He wanted to join in the 30s, and they turned him down. So we have to look at...
That's just another example of how foolish they were, really.
But, totally. God, they didn't know what they were doing. Yeah. But you do have to look at the time frame. And then
right.
What is so hideous, and it's too long, and it's really very well done in this book, she says, the Lies and Spies chapter, is that people have taken some Russian files called the Venona files and have tried to place Izzy within it. And I don't know if Eric Alterman did this piece with where I showed that Walter Lippmann was in these files, or the person they assumed was Walter Lippmann, was in these files far more than Izzy. And what the three times that they had Izzy in there is that Izzy was ducking some guy who was a KGB head, but he was also the head of the TASS press attaché, the press attaché for the Russians. And it was at a time when they were our allies. And this has been blown into such disgusting proportions that it's hard to even, I try to be humorous about it.
Well, I would say you conclusively disprove the allegation that Izzy was a KGB agent in the chapter that you mentioned.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Just,
there was never any substance to that, and you blow it up. You blow up the insubstantial and destroy it. And yet,
but that's my problem about the blogosphere, because you can look these things up, and you can look at Wikipedia, and this stuff is still in there, because they quote from people like Ann Coulter and others who just have no sense of decency or honesty.
Well, there were plenty of lies being spread around before the blogosphere existed. I mean, Robert Novak was telling lies like this long before anybody posted them on the internet.
I also nail Novak.
The New York Post published this in editorials years ago, and you know that's old media doing the dirty work. So,
well, as late as 2003, when God, I'm blanking on his name. How can I do that? Who ran for president? Oh, come on, Myra.
Pat Buchanan.
No, John Edwards.
Oh, John Edwards.
Excuse me. Poor John. Anyway, he was on a show, and he said, when asked what was his favorite book, he said, that what was he currently reading? And he said, Izzy's book, The Trial of Socrates. And Bob Novak said, doesn't he know that he was on the payroll of the Russian...
Not Socrates, Izzy.
Izzy. Well, maybe both.
Yeah.
And this is 2004.
Yeah.
2000. It's just utterly awful. And
well, nevertheless, I mean, when I was growing up, we got the weekly in the house every week, and I knew Izzy because, as I said, a member of my family was married to a member of his family, and so I knew him growing up, and we got the weekly, and yet. My dad, who was from an anarchist background and didn't have any use for communists at all,
no.
Even though some of them were friends and relatives, had his favorite joke about Izzy, which was that when Izzy came back, and he knew Izzy well, when Izzy came back from Russia
56.
In 1956, he came back and he was shocked, my dad said, that they had no habeas corpus in the Soviet Union. And this gave my father a great laugh because of, you know, all the crimes of Stalinism and all the oppression and repression there, and that Izzy would seize on the fact that they didn't have habeas corpus, which was admittedly a very bad thing. But was this reflected, I guess my dad thought, a certain naivete about the Soviets that he harbored even perhaps 20 years longer than he should have.
I don't know. If you read the book, there are many times where Izzy spoke out against Russia early on. He warned the country not to go the way of Stalin during the McCarthy period, the repression of freedoms. He
didn't take the Russian line.
Never
on major
did he
issues.
Take the never. And in fact, the Daily Worker used to knock him. In fact, the FBI used a line that said, "Well, the Daily Worker." Wrote about Izzy, but they never quoted the stuff they said about him, which was
that
he was
not
a party line.
He was not sufficiently critical, though, of the communists until a certain point, that he himself felt that he had held back.
He held back, but he held back for a moral reason, and he has a great line about that, and saying that he hated the morass that one finds oneself into if one tries to withhold the truth. And he said the reason he had done it was for peaceful coexistence, but he could no longer feel that way after he had been there. And it wasn't just that they had no habeas corpus. He had a meeting on a corner with somebody, and it was all set to meet him, and the man said that he couldn't meet him, and he saw the shadowy figures across the street and everything. But my feeling on Izzy is that it wasn't so much that he didn't come forth about Russia and Stalin, as it was that he didn't feel that he had to prove his Americanism. Izzy was one of the most American people you could find. He was constantly extolling the freedoms that we have and that no one else has. It was so much a part of his thinking.
And eventually became a great critic of Soviet repression and a friend of the Soviet dissidents.
Oh, for three decades. And he was constantly supporting the dissidents. But what I'm trying to say is that in the midst of McCarthyism, where there was the loyalty oath, the Red Scare was going on, and that was so injurious to his way of thinking, he thought, I'm not going to add another scintilla of stuff to what's going on. What I'm going to say is what's wrong in America, which is people cannot think, they cannot speak, they are being held and incommunicado sometimes.
Well, I remember.
And they were going, as we all know, they were going after what they called front groups and calling them subversive after the fact. And some of them were little old ladies who had given clothes to Russia during the war and the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. So he felt that his job and his role was to try to keep America free. He told me this great line once. He said, during this period when he was a total pariah and everybody was afraid to even be with him because he was speaking out against McCarthy, people have no idea how difficult and brave that was.
He was very lonely. I remember
my
mother and father telling me it was shameful the way a lot of people kind of turned away from him.
And
at that time.
There was one of my friends, Dick Dudman, who was on the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, had a dinner party, and he had a USIA guy come in, and Izzy waltzed in, and the man turned around and grabbed Dick and took him into the kitchen, and he said, isn't that Izzy Stone? And he said, yes. He said, what are you doing having me in the same house with him? I could lose my job. And so he decided that he wasn't going to tell Izzy anything, and years later, Izzy and Esther were standing there talking, and Esther said, oh, I still remember that wonderful party you were
with. Esther being Mrs. Stone.
Yes, I still remember that wonderful party, and you were the one who took us in when no one else would. So Dick says, well, I can tell you this story. And so he tells the story, and I said, what was Izzy's reaction? He said, he immediately wanted to know who this son of a bitch was. It didn't matter how many years had gone by. So it was not a good time, but his line to me was, he said, he used to shake his fist at the Capitol, and he'd say, you know, damn it all, I just may be a Jew red to you, but I'm keeping Jefferson alive. and that was so much
and that
his
was
feeling.
Very true.
Yeah. So I think he's gotten a bad
let's
rap.
Let's talk about Esther for a second.
Oh, yes, let's.
Because there would have been no Izzy without Esther.
No, absolutely. She, I think, was... she was also very smart and very full of private little wisdom, and I knew
her
slightly.
First of all, how long were they married? They were
61 years.
61 years, right.
And it's interesting because Celia, his daughter, talked very candidly about how she felt. I had the same kind of mother. I had a mother who did everything for my father, and we were in that.
And had no career of her own.
Right. And I think Esther and I were on, I mean, not Esther, but Celia and I were on that cutting edge of women who said, we're not going to be that way.
Right.
And so she saw the dichotomy between what she wanted to be and what her mom was, but she was, she just adored and loved and did everything for Izzy and gave him a kind of rock that a lot of people would love to have had as far as anything he did. In fact, there's a funny story about Izzy. He could be abrasive and...
Cranky,
and he went to a party.
Egotistical.
There's two stories. I'll tell you the one, the egotistical was when he was giving a speech on Socrates, the trial of Socrates, and he said, in my book, I wrote a speech for Socrates, and everybody started tittering, and he said, and if he had delivered that, he would have been acquitted.
And he meant it.
And he meant it, yes. He wasn't at all. But the other story was that he went into a memorial service for Walter Lippmann, and it was full of everybody, just huzzah, huzzah, wonderful Walter Lippmann. And Izzy got up, and he said, he was wrong about Sacco and Vanzetti. And if you think that's an Italian law firm, it was the two anarchists who had gotten... railroaded into being executed. And so Esther said that he stalked out. Oh, and then he said, and he should, which I am very critical of in the book, he said he didn't write anything about the Holocaust, which is quite a staggering examination of the way Lippmann approached it. But Esther said, you know, he left me, walked out and left me holding the bag with all of these people. I see Carl Bernstein here, too, and I wanted to say hello because Carl knew, I think you knew him before anybody in this room. Weren't you about 5 years old?
Now, I guess, you know, people could say Izzy was wrong about Stalinism, or at least he was late on that score, but was vindicated about so many other things, not
totally.
Just World War II, but his ideas about peaceful coexistence, ideas that were very, very radical when he enunciated them, turned out to be the completely conventional wisdom of conservative politicians, and he lived to see that.
He had a great, great funny line about when he was 80 years old, and it was, and he said, you know, who would have thought it? Nixon, that old red baiter, first would meet with Mao, and he said, and now we have Reagan going to a summit with Gorbachev. And
right.
These right-wing or Republicans were doing exactly what he had been saying all along. And he has some very lyrical pieces of writing in this book in which he talks about a world in which we can all annihilate each other. And if the only way you can handle that is to... You have to live with them if we're going to live on this planet. And I think one of the points about Izzy was that he had a great gift for really moving writing. He was one of the scoops he got was the first person in the world to go with the Holocaust survivors to Palestine. And he wrote this book that is magical called Underground to Palestine about being with all of them. And then he writes one line in it saying that this was 1946, mind you, that it should be a binational state, that there's
right.
no way that you can do
that
this.
Israel should be a binational.
Israel, and there was absolutely no way that you couldn't recognize that these people had to have their land as well. And so Izzy went to lunch with a lot of American Jewish leaders, and they loved the book. He had gotten 250,000 readers every.
This is when he was writing for PM.
PM every single day. It was a five-part series, so they go to lunch with Izzy and say, "We want to really push this." And in 1946, we're going to give you $25,000 to promote the book. I would take that today. I mean, it was really a great amount of money, and Izzy.
But if.
Wait a minute. But and Izzy said he sat there and he looked down and then they said, "There's just one line we want you to cut." And he said, "Well, what's the one line?" And they said, "This business about a binational state." And Izzy said, "I can't do that." He said, "My publisher, I wrote it that way for PM, and I will write it this way." And Izzy said, "That was the end of lunch and effectively the end of the book." They just disappeared with the money.
Well, the book was published, though.
Not well. I mean, it didn't.
But then it was reissued some years ago.
Yeah, in 74, I think, 75.
Because by then, Izzy had become a Jewish dissident in America against the mainstream position of Jewish and Zionist organizations, even though he was one of the original Zionists in his own way.
But he wrote a wonderful... wonderful article about the other Zionism and explained that there were those who felt like he did early on and had recognized...
Including Einstein,
Exactly, and that had recognized the need for that.
And gotten a lot of trouble for that, didn't he?
Oh, yes. I don't know. He was... was at one place where he was booed and hissed for... And yes, he did. And he used to say that he tried to make light of it. He'd say, sooner or later, if you're an iconoclast, you're going to get in trouble with your tribe. And he said, I was loved until I was no longer kosher. I mean, he would make jokes about it. But he also felt very strongly, at least what he said to me, and I have not seen it any other places, and one of his children said he was surprised that he would have said it. But he did say that being maligned and harassed by Jews were the only thing that really upset him. He could take everything else.
Because he was very...
Nixon was, you know, Nixon took off on him, and he'd say, oh, that was a mere flea bite, you know. It wasn't important. But he really felt hurt.
When he went underground to Palestine, he said something like, to his children, by the way, when he was setting out on this trip, he sat at the breakfast table and said something on the order of, boy, you know, I won't mind if the Arabs shoot me, but it would be...
I sure as hell would hate to be shot by a Jew.
which was a live possibility at that point. But because he was very Jewish, in spite of being not religious.
Oh, he was religious. He read the Bible. He always used to say that Jesus was the first socialist.
I'm sorry. Not religious is the wrong way to put it. Not a regular attendant at synagogue.
No. And but he did. They had, as I remember, he did seders and at times and things like that. But
well, you have a funny story about him having a Christmas tree.
Oh yeah, it's in the book.
That he then hustled upstairs because
my friend Madeline told
me Jewish students were coming over.
No, he had some Jewish kids who were out there, and he was marching them for the Haganah to go into.
Oh, that's right. He was giving military training.
He was giving with sticks, wooden sticks.
In the backyard, yeah.
In the backyard with sticks. And Madeline saw him. And then she saw him and Esther dragging the Christmas tree up to the top floor because before these kids came because he didn't want them to see it. He also was pretty, you know, Victor Navasky always does a very, I think, funny bit about Izzy always... saying that he did not have to take a vow of poverty to be on the right side. And he bragged that he got Esther a mink coat. And he used to joke about Vietnam when he did become very, very rich. I mean, you do the math, and he was making $350,000 a year grossing in 1970, which is, I don't know, one point some million.
It's a lot of money,
It's a lot of money. But he used to say that he was a war profiteer.
Every editor whoever published him would complain about... Because I remember when I worked at the Village Voice, he wrote some pieces for us, and the editor then, David Schneiderman, would, knowing that I had a relationship with him, would just come down and moan and groan about Izzy, you know, squeezing every possible dollar out of him. So yes, he did like to make a good living, and he did. Which is an amazing thing, isn't it, that he became so successful?
He was a huge self-promoter. Some very funny things in the book about all of his advertising when he started up the weekly, and it was just keep on going. And one of them was, and he said, as it seemed that subscriptions had triumphed and dignity prevailed, Stone would pop up now and again with a plea, such as this Christmas jingle staple. Wrote Stone, it may not be Shakespeare, but it sure went to our circulation manager's heart. Keep your diamonds, cashmeres, furs, and Cadillacs marked his and hers. Just give me for my very own another year of I.F. Stone. And he was always saying, give this book to
it. Well, it was a bargain, too. It was only $5 a year at that time.
Yeah, it always was. He never changed it.
What made him decide late in life that he had to learn to read ancient Greek and write this book about Socrates?
It really wasn't. It goes really back to his
which was his
roots.
Only best-selling book, right?
Yeah. I mean, but he went back to his roots in philosophy. He had been a philosophy major. Izzy was not what you'd call a student. He graduated third in his class, and that's from the bottom. And he then...
Say that again, third from the bottom?
Yes.
Yeah. As I said to somebody, I was thrown out of Fieldston School, actually. said I went to the ethical schools, but I was kicked out. So
Izzy said I wasn't.
Makes me feel a little better.
He said I wasn't dumb. I just didn't study. But
and never went to college, right?
No, he went to Temple. The funny thing is
went to Temple University.
Yeah.
The
funny
graduate.
Thing is that he went. What? Temple. Excuse me. Temple. Sure. No, University of Pennsylvania.
University of Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Excusez-moi. Anyway, he.
These facts are all correct in the book, by the way.
Yeah. I hope they're all correct. But he was there, and he started writing at age 15 for the newspaper.
Right.
And he just fell madly in love with journalism, and he didn't...
Pretty much dropped out.
Yeah, but he was very proud of the honorariums he would get, you know, the graduate degrees he would get.
Oh, and there are pictures of him with a mortarboard.
Oh, yeah, he loved that. And he also, at one point, wanted to go to Harvard, which was quite ridiculous.
He
giving
was kind
his,
of a scholar mancam, you know, when and had great disdain for journalism school, by the way. Anybody here who's thinking of going to journalism school, I remember when I was a freshman, I had enrolled in a journalism course or major at the school I was attending, and I had dinner with him, and he said, "So Joe, what are you doing? You know, what's?" And I said, "Well, Izzy," very proudly, "I'm going to journalism school." And he looked at me, and he kind of squinted at me, and he said, "Journalism school? You won't learn anything in journalism school. Study history so you'll know what you're talking about." And I, of course, immediately, the next day, re-enrolled as a history major, because he was a great student.
Well, he was absolutely correct.
History.
But he was, and
yes,
he was a
correct.
True autodidact. He read everything in sight. He knew, and he could quote, and he had an absolutely astounding memory, which allowed him to go back into reading anything he wanted. But he cared about art. He cared about theater. He cared about philosophy. He cared about all of history. And I think what he did that was phenomenal is that he took history into the present and was able to write about it in a way that illustrated what was going on and in many ways was prescient about the future. He took a lot of the writers to task about when they were writing about Vietnam because he said they didn't go back very far. They never really read what had gone on with Bernard Fall, the French historian. Izzy was able to traced eloquently the steps that went on that got us into Vietnam. And that kind of reporting isn't done that much. And
in a way, the trial of Socrates is perhaps more relevant now than when he wrote it.
Yeah.
It's the story of a dissident who is in trouble with his own society. And
except Izzy just said Socrates was a snob. he was not into... He got a lot of criticism for his Socrates book. He had an original thought.
Explain, why was he criticized for that book?
Well, actually, I shouldn't say a lot. He had a bad review from a guy who didn't like him for a very long time, Sidney Hook, so that's probably the one I remember the most. But he
couldn't have been surprised by that.
I think he was surprised that the Wall Street Journal gave him the review. I mean, we've all been there, right? You get a review
yes.
from somebody that you can't imagine they gave it to. But he said publicly that he had no quarrel with Hook, but he talked to another person who had written a book on him. He called him that bastard. I think like all writers, you really hate to have a bad review. And he totally took a view that a lot of scholars were critical of because they thought, as he said, they look at me as just a journalist. But it didn't faze him. He was on to the next serious book.
Oh, he could have cared less what anybody
no.
else thought about
and
that.
And he was right. already, you know, when he died, he was ready to go into
Myra,
another
I
one.
I want to take some questions from the audience, so
well,
I think we should
absolutely.
Stop soon. Is there something we've missed that...
Oh, dear. I don't think
I mean, there's
so.
A lot we've missed. But
yeah. Well, one of the things is the Korean War, which was the nadir of his life. Everybody said, oh, he was... too sympathetic to the communists and that he said that the South started the war. Well, he was very wrong about that. But he was right about three things that a lot of people don't know, and that was that he was very early on saying you cannot get into a war in Indochina. You cannot underestimate the kind of peasant guerrilla fighting that they would do. That would be a very hard war. A second one was that the communists were not monolithic. Well, we all know that now, but when Izzy was saying that in the 50s, that was really quite remarkable. And the third thing was that Stalin did not start the war either, and that has been in our history books forever. But there are the new Woodrow Wilson Cold War History Project has all of the notes. I was able to see the letters that Stalin wrote to Mao, in which he was dragging his feet and dragging his feet because he didn't want to go into a war with the United States. And Izzy nailed that. He said that at the time, and everybody thought he was just making up excuses. So he not only was he right at the time, but in many instances, time has proven him right.
And in a time when journalism has brought so much discredit on itself, what is the most important thing that journalists could learn from his life?
Well, I'd start with the not listening to the flattery that comes. It's endemic. You've been in Washington, and I always call it the comma name comma school of political people. They come up to you and they say, "Well, Joe, I think, well, Myra." I mean, somebody has told them what your name is, and they're going to do this. And way too many people in Washington just fall for the flattery. And Izzy's great line was, you know, you really have to wear your chastity belt to preserve your journalistic integrity in Washington. He said, as soon as the Secretary of State asks you to lunch and asks your opinion, you're sunk. And that's why I twin him with Lippmann all the time, because Lippmann was so much a part of kings and leaders that when he went to Paris, his forwarding address was in care of Charles de Gaulle. And he was, the great story was he told somebody, "Well, we're going to get out of Vietnam. I know we're going to get out of Vietnam." And somebody said, "Why? And how do you feel that way?" And he said, "Well, Nixon told me." And Izzy was always saying, don't fall for that. That's first. Second, read the documents, find stuff. Izzy would read from the index forward and find things that were in plain sight that other people just couldn't find.
Always missed.
And always missed. Third is to find a really honest-to-God, legitimate whistleblower. Do your homework. Don't ever go and interview somebody without knowing what's going on, and so that when they answer you with a puff answer, you can continue to ask and ask. It's sort of like the lawyer. No lawyer, good lawyer, ever asks a question if he doesn't know what they're going to say. And he was very strong on that. And also just have a good time. He used to say that you can't feel like a martyr, and if you want to change the world in a meager 2 centuries or so, of course it looks hopeless. So I think his optimism and ebullience for life, I mean, we didn't get into the fact that he was a great, he loved to dance all the time, and he was he loved the rhythm and beat of rock music. He and Esther were the oldest people on the floor at a place in San Francisco called Dance Your Ass Off. And he loved to dance because he could feel the rhythm up through his feet.
Before. He might have liked it better since he couldn't actually hear the music. But
Well.
On that note, I'd love to take some questions. We don't have that much time left, but I believe people were given cards to fill out if they had questions. And I'm sure Myra would like to answer them, so.
Or if you want to shout.
Well, no, there's a system here.
Oh, there is a system.
I was instructed to follow, and people are dutifully filling out cards, so. And I'm supposed to read them too.
All right.
If I can read, people are using their handwriting. Wait a minute.
You're going to have to confess and put your glasses on,
no,
Joe.
Wait a minute. Yeah, well, I'm not sure the glasses would help. That's the only reason I didn't. Okay. Well, this is what you were just talking about. As an objective investigative journalist, how could Stone have gotten it so wrong about Korea?
Well, I think I answered Korea. I'm sorry? I just said I think I answered that to some degree. I think he had an ideological bias. He also was able to see a lot of things in this book he did about Korea, The Hidden History, of how the machinations that went on with MacArthur and everybody else. So I think he was wrong about that one part, but that was not the totality of that book. There was a lot more to it than that one part. Also, I have a feeling, I say that Izzy was the practitioner of what I call real objectivity as opposed to faux objectivity. And faux objectivity is when you go to a McNamara or a Cheney or a president and they give you something and then you have to run it. And real objectivity is if you then say, however, this is the reality. If you have to quote an official source, which everybody always says you have to do in mainstream journalism, then it behooves you to know whether that person is telling you a lie or not. And that's my theory of what objective journalism should be.
Quickly, before I proceed with more questions, I want to ask everybody to make a donation. There'll be some baskets passed around, and I think it behooves us
to all me.
To support the Ethical Culture Society and also buy Myra's book, naturally. So I hope you'll all give something. Here's a question. Who are the few reporters today? Why are there so few reporters today that follow the Stone tradition, and who are they? Who are the few?
Well, I think Walter Pink has put it. He said it's a lot of work to do what Izzy did, and a lot of people don't have.
I would say Walter is definitely one of the few.
Exactly, that's why I quoted him. And you don't have the time often to do what Izzy did. I think Cy Hirsch is very good. I think David Korn, there are a lot of people, I think, who are carrying on the tradition of Izzy, but you have to breed, which is a sort of paleolithic knowledge for some of the younger people.
In some ways, it's easier than it used to be. I mean, in some ways, because of the internet and the World Wide Web, there's a tremendous number of documents that are available.
Absolutely.
You can sit in your house and get things that Izzy would have had to lurk in the corridors.
Yeah,
he said he
could have saved 30 years of his life.
Yeah, so there's even less of an excuse than there
and
used to
be. Yeah, and I do think some of the blogs are good in that respect.
Here's a question that's very easy to answer. Did I.F. Stone publish a monthly newsletter called In Fact?
No, George Seldes.
No, that was George Seldes, who was his friend and colleague and somebody he was a bit older, who I think Izzy looked up to.
I interviewed George Seldes when he was 101, the oldest person I interviewed for the book. And he had an interesting story. He said that when he quit In Fact, which was the only other muckraking individual, he in 1964 was writing about how cigarettes cause cancer, and he was going up against the big corporations, and Izzy called him the granddaddy of investigative reporters. Well, when Izzy wanted to start the weekly, he said he wanted his list, and according to George, he said, I want Izzy to be independent from me because I was red-baited out of publication, and he didn't want to do that.
Here's another question. Do you think reporters today are intimidated by the culture of fear that is spread in society?
Well, I certainly think the 9/11 culture of fear has been promulgated to the degree that journalists are not willing to stand up and speak out about it. I also think we have to face the fact that we are in a corporate monopoly world in which the status quo is what people want. And Izzy used to joke that publishers made $1 million selling toilet paper and went out and bought a newspaper as a tax dodge. Well, now it's about $100 million or more. And what's scary today is that Ben Bradley said that there isn't a meeting or a conference in which they don't discuss how can we get more readership. And I think that you're getting a lot of fluff and the Angelina baby routine. Because I call it the peopleization of journalism. People Magazine started that, and celebrity trash has taken over. It's just there's non-existent news on television if you have something like JonBenet's supposed killer. That if you just I just monitored it to see what was on, and there was nothing. It was at the very same time that the Supreme Court was ruling on Guantanamo, and you couldn't find anything. And I think there is this culture of ignorance that is being abetted.
But is fear the reason why a newspaper like the Washington Post, for example, would whose editors I'm sure would profess to think very highly of I.F. Stone, nevertheless do exactly the same thing that their predecessors would have done during Vietnam, which is to bury the facts about Iraq, bury Walter's story. I mean, he was lucky to get it published.
I think there was...
Why is it that these people who claim to have learned the lessons of the life of somebody like I.F. Stone continue to behave exactly the same way that somewhere inside they know they shouldn't?
Well, I can tell you that the Post has had its various... faces, and the one right now is not very pleasant, I don't think. I think there is a drift. I think there is a conservative drift in American journalism, and some of it is just a belief. The op-ed of the Washington Post, it's very hard to find dissenting points of view, and that was what Izzy always said. They needed the opinion, they needed dissenting voices. I'm just talking about the op-ed page. The story that the Post wrote about weapons of mass destruction had some not very smart people, it sounded. There was an editor who was quoted as saying that they did not use a piece by Tom Ricks, who has written the great book Fiasco.
Right.
He said because his sources were all old, retired guys. And somebody else said, well...
You might actually know something.
Yeah, and another one that said Walter was... difficult, you had to edit him, which is true, but
Of course, the New York Times did the same thing.
Yeah.
And again, a newspaper that is edited, I'm sure, by people who would tell you what a great guy I.F. Stone was and how much they admired him and looked up to him, they would publish, a lot of administration propaganda from the likes of Judith Miller. It's stunning to me, and you worked at a daily newspaper in Washington, so you know.
But I was there at a different time. I was there at a different time. I was writing the Watergate profiles that went along with the major lead stories. We wrote tough things back then. I really don't have a good answer. I wish I did. I don't understand it. I've seen an enormous... There are these cyclical changes. After McCarthy, everybody did a mea culpa. Oh, we've got to be... We just cannot quote these people endlessly. Then after Vietnam, now after weapons of mass destruction. And there's all... The ombudsman in the New York Times has been very tough about the fact that they held the story for... more than a year,
right.
And after the election on the finance...
The NSA.
NSA, yes. Financing. And so I don't know. I think it's to make a buck. I think that let's not rock any boats. I know that's a simplistic answer, and maybe somebody out here would like to answer it better than I. I mean, maybe Victor or somebody could.
I'm sorry, I'm looking for the... Oh, here's someone who asks, I.F. Stone, great personality or great reporter or both?
Both. <That's>, I guess we can end on that one.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you, Myra.
This recording was made available by the New York Sound Posse, online at nysoundposse.com.